Hi, podcast listeners. It's Doug here. So we are going to be doing an occasional series in the coming months, talking about great films and the great directors who made them. We'll have more details about all of this when we work out the details, but we're going to jump in this week with a conversation about the work of Wes Anderson. The Salt Lake Film Society has been screening his films over the last few weeks. They're also screening the work of the other great director named Anderson, Paul Thomas Anderson. But we spoke this week with the writer and film critic Ian Nathan about Wes Anderson, and he said his first encounter with him was the film Rushmore. And he had the same kind of reaction a lot of us have when we first see a Wes Anderson movie. It's really great, but we're not quite sure what to make of it.
A lot of people's early reaction to Wes Anderson, and I mean this in a positive way, is slight befuddlement. I hadn't seen Bottle Rocket, and I saw Rushmore. I worked for a film magazine, so we saw a lot of the films. But it was a Disney movie, so you kind of go in expecting a kind of Disney adult comedy. And what we got was a fabulous movie, but a very distinctive film that maybe I wasn't quite ready for. I think you have to make a kind of adjustment. You have to sort of hit a tuning fork for Wes Anderson. And once you have that in your brain, it's a wonderful place to be. But if you haven't got it yet, you sort of come out going, was that film exactly funny? It felt a bit sad, and it felt kind of quite depressing. It's about emotions, and it took me a little while to process, and probably a couple more screenings before I realized I did actually love Rushmore.
Mm. You describe it as both heartfelt and cynical. So those kind of things put together seem at odds in some way.
Yeah, there's something very contradictory about the way Wes Anderson goes about things. He's kind of silly and incredibly clever, you know, heartfelt and cynical. He is very funny, yet deeply moving. His films are highly processed, you know, to the point where the image is kind of always, is locked in like a tableau, you know, and he's such a distinctive style. Yet they feel kind of freeform at the same time. They're kind of rigid films about the chaos of human emotions. So he's full of contradictions. And I think that's true of the great artists. Genius is having two opposing thoughts in your brain at one, you know, in one time and making sense of them, or words to that effect. And I think that's true of Wes Anderson. He manages to be opposites all the time. And I think that's what he sees in the world.
I wonder. There's this story about Anderson. This was actually right around the time that he had made Rushmore, and he had this affection for or obsession with the film critic Pauline Kael. And they talked, and she told him that she didn't know quite what to make of Rushmore, which made me wonder, maybe it was the same reaction that you had, but it also made me wonder about the sort of the originality of his style in those days. People didn't have a sense of an Anderson style just yet. They didn't know it quite yet. I don't know if you know that story, but it seems like that is a reaction.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, he's obsessive with Anderson about so many things and a collector. Mm. You look at his films, they're like the collections of things, literally and sort of figuratively. And I think he was obsessed about Pauline Kael because at college he'd read all the New Yorkers, had back issues in the New Yorkers in the college library. And because being Wes Anderson, he read all of them and obsessed about her as a critic. And he's an intellectual, that he would have fed upon the way she approached film, which was very intellectually, but also about sort of immediate responses. Pauline Kael's sort of feelings for film was you had to react. You had to get something from it straight away. You go in, you get the film. You don't have to think about it afterwards. I think she was sort of troubled a little bit about the feelings similar to the things I had. And I don't equate myself with Pauline Kael in any way, but you know the kind of feelings of what is this? You know, how am I meant to respond to it? And I think she was slightly troubled by that, a little bit more troubled by me. But you know, he turned up on her doorstep virtually. He arranged this screening.
Right.
Turned up at her apartment, and she was a bit like, "Who are you, kid?" You know, and he sort of takes it to the cinema in this very bizarre kind of exercise, which he goes along with. But I think she was taken aback by how forward he was. And it wasn't a sort of perfect encounter, maybe, that Wes Anderson had envisioned. But he must have known that's what she was like, and that was her attitude to things. And she wasn't going to be won over by this kid in a brown corduroy jacket, you know, just turning up, you know, to pay homage to her.
Yeah. How do you, I don't know, describe, or what do you make of the sensibility that people often identify in a Wes Anderson film that gets called twee or quaintly ironic? Do you think that's dismissive, or, you know, I don't know, overly reductive, or isn't quite getting at Anderson?
Well, I think, like all things in the Anderson universe, it's true, but not the point.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, yes, their films are twee. They're very designed. The color palettes, the kind of the symmetrical images, the way he operates with actors. I mean, it's a great joke, but it's kind of true that his stop motion films and his real life films are not that far apart in the sense of how they operate, because that's kind of what he does. So he creates this kind of fake veneer, like a tea set of a film that has a delicacy to it. But the point is that just sets up, you know, what's going on beneath the surface. So you watch a film like Royal Tenenbaums, which is extremely organized and kind of deliberate. And it's almost, you know, it's narrated as a film. So it's a story being told to you within the story. So everything is very rigid. Yet it's about quite a profound thing. And as soon as you're attuned to that, you realize that Wes Anderson's directorial handwriting is something that's all important. It's his style, and it's not going to change. And that's a way he tells his story, and like a very distinctive novelist, that you can operate in this style. And what's interesting is what he's writing about and how that style evokes it. And that becomes the exploration you go on with Anderson. And I think for some viewers who like naturalism, who want their stories to be kind of very obvious and told to them, find that frustrating and find it hard to take, and come up with phrases like, oh, it's all very clever and twee, it's ironic, I can't get involved. And I think you need to work at it a little bit. I think you need to step into the world and meet him there, and then you get enormous pleasures from it.
Well, I think you had this insight that I think gets at that. You wrote that Anderson's movies may not be set in reality, strictly speaking, but they are about real things.
Oh, absolutely. You know, they're all about real things, and almost shockingly so. And they're about fathers, they're about children, they're about family. Probably his fundamental subject is families. They are about human interactions. They are about fame and the desire for fame. And they're about extraordinary range of things. But I think fundamentally they're about people, as all great, great kind of movies are. They're a study in the way humans operate. And I think on another level, Wes Anderson films are about Wes Anderson. Royal Tenenbaums is about his parents' divorce. That's what it's about, in his own reaction to it. Bottle Rocket is about growing up, you know, with his mates in Austin and Texas and Dallas. They're all about him in a way. And even you think like Grand Budapest Hotel, which is set vastly in the past, but the way that film operates, I think, is a study of art and a study of an artist at work. It's perfect concierge. So I think they're about incredibly real things, and that's the beauty of them, and that's what you go in search of. And you can look for the next film, and you have to get through the whole, isn't this the same as the last film? And you realize it's totally different. It's just the style that remains consistent.
What do we know about his early life that contributes to his aesthetic, you know, to his style? Not the family dysfunction part, which we'll actually come back to, but what is it about his life, if we know, that contributed to his, you know, obsession over collection, over trying to make these tableaus, like his aesthetic? Do we know? He grew up in Texas. Maybe it's the influence of his parents. His mother, an archaeologist. His father, sort of a PR guy. What do we know about that contributed to his style?
Well, I think while he did grow up in Texas, he doesn't fit the Texan archetype,
as you will. Right.
He went to a kind of boys' school that was kind of, so in English terms, we would call it sort of public school, but it's a private school. And he grew up, I think, with brothers. He grew up in a household that was very free in terms of its expression. But I think he was precocious, quite naturally. And precocity needs feeding. And early on, he kind of acted out of it because he was a storyteller, and I think he hadn't located that yet. And I think a lot of that high-functioning mind he clearly has was very frustrated at school, and I think he needed an outlet, and that comes through an obsession with film. And he had quite a normal obsession. And in some ways, yeah, he's a very normal guy. He liked Star Wars. He liked Indiana Jones. He liked movies. But he gets to college. I mean, college is kind of almost the making of him, where he meets Owen Wilson and he's doing playwriting course. But he discovers this sort of college library. And the library, you know, is sort of an essential part of the psyche, I think, of Wes Anderson, in that this kind of cataloging and storing. And this, he finds all these videotapes that he can watch. So if you want to watch a director, he can watch all of the director's work, process it all at once. Yeah, if he wants to find a copy of the New Yorker, he can find all of the copies of New Yorker. So he starts, I think he gets this idea of populating things and using that kind of idea. And then that translates to the plays he wants to do. And within that, there is the mother, there is the archaeology, there is the kind of numbering and labeling of things that, you know, all his films do. They're kind of archaeological digs, his films. So you get that as well. And he's an outsider. It must seem very odd growing up in Texas when you aspire to be a New York intellectual. Yeah. And you're on a different planet. So I think that he must have absorbed very much. And he's kind of in a different planet in Hollywood as well. He's very much his own guy.
Yeah. You mention that he is in control of the process of making a film in a way that most directors aren't. You know, the mood boards and the color schemes and the camera moves that he lays out. But you also write about the fact that, you know, here he is, this slender, soft-spoken guy, never raises his voice on set, but everyone knows who's in charge. And you talk about this experience he has with Gene Hackman, which, I don't know, that seemed to say a lot about his process. I wanted you to talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, he's an interesting sort of conundrum as a director, in that he doesn't shout and doesn't lose his cool. He's very calm and wants his sets to have that aura of like a library, that everything's done in its kind of perfect way. Well, he talks about allowing improvisation amongst the actors, but not allowing them to change a line. So it's again, it's a contradiction that the script is absolutely finished and done and you've got to stick to it. But then how they work with that is where he allows some latitude. But given how designed his shots are and how designed his worlds are, you wonder how much room there is. And of course, this troubled Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman was someone, he plays Royal Tenenbaum in the Royal Tenenbaums, and Wes Anderson had sought him out. He'd written the screenplay and thought, this is Gene Hackman. I've written him in, Gene Hackman in my head is already playing the role. And it took him a long time to win over Gene Hackman with this part. It was a small film. Hackman sort of coming towards the end of his career as an actor and was getting less and less interested in sort of being adventurous. But he thought he'd done his time, Hackman. And there's this young, guy on only his third film, sort of talking about this strange comedy that he wants to do about a dysfunctional family and how he's the patriarch. But he woos Hackman with scripts and letters and promises, and even a painting of Gene Hackman is sent to him. And so Hackman sort of gives in. But it's a difficult relationship on set, because Hackman came from the method school. He came from the New York sort of 70s school of Pacino and Tommy Lee Jones, all these guys that sort of studied in New York and wanted to sort of get on with it and be an actor. Yet here was this kind of rather rigid young director who liked to kind of be precise and liked to kind of have his film organized. Mm-hmm. And it was not a meeting of minds. But you see, beneath that, a kind of perfection is at work, because that's exactly who Royal Tenenbaum is. He's the disruptor in the family. He is the kind of the chaotic force that has caused all this kind of terrible dysfunction amongst his children. And you think, well, that's kind of beautiful. Even though I think it was very hard for Wes Anderson, who did hero worship Hackman in many ways, loved his movies. And they had a very kind of fierce confrontation. But if you kind of take the story of the confrontation, which I put into the book, about this kind of Hackman dragging him into the games cupboard of the Tenenbaum house and sort of swearing at him in a particularly distinct way.
Yeah.
And Anderson sort of defending himself, okay, you don't really mean this, you don't really mean this. It's a scene from the movie.
That's what it is.
And that's kind of what's so interesting. And I think in a strange way, whether Anderson would admit it or not, I think he must have fed that. He must have fed that on set, that he must have known he was frustrating Hackman and carried on frustrating Hackman, although Hackman sort of lightened up a bit, that it would help the movie. And that maybe was why he cast him, is that he wanted a contradiction within the mix of his films. And it rarely happened that way. If you look across all the films that Anderson's made before and after the Royal Tenenbaum, Hackman almost stands apart.
Yeah.
And is this sort of chaotic thing that's been thrown into the mix. All the other films are built around and collected the Anderson actors.
Yeah.
Even Bill Murray's very much on side and does the Anderson thing. Ralph Fiennes hadn't made a film before with Wes Anderson, but he joined in very quickly. Whereas Hackman's about the only example of someone who didn't get it, didn't want to get it. And yet you watch the film and he's a wonderful Anderson character. So while he may not be a shouter, Wes Anderson, or seem like one of these domineering personalities, he certainly gets his way on set.
Does Wes Anderson... I guess I'm wondering, what do you think Wes Anderson's influence on the performance? What is that? People have described in some ways, and maybe this is just the writing, but I think in some ways it must be Anderson's influence on the process, and that, you know, there's a more kind of deadpan delivery often, and maybe it's just the conceit of the film itself. But how do you describe, I guess, the relationship that he has with the performance of the actors?
It is interesting, actually. It's a good question, and I think, you know, there is a very distinctive style of acting that happens within Anderson films that you allude to. And it's part of the thing what frustrates some people, that, you know, they never quite get to these characters because they're all behaving in this kind of strange deadpan manner, aloof from, you know, being a real character somehow, sort of distant, yet very present in terms of the outward reaction. You think of Bill Murray across all the films, you know, from Rushmore, Steve Zissou, you know, all of, you know, he's so there within the film and it works. I always think about, you know, a lot of these films are sort of studies in depression. And I think a lot of the performances are about depression and how people get when they're depressed. And I think that is sort of a thing that Anderson kind of places on his actors. But he must be, it must be a kind of schooling you have to go for and an understanding you have to get to in terms of how you perform in Wes Anderson's film. Becomes very distinctive. It's almost like going and doing Shakespeare, because you have to sort of step into a Shakespearean universe and perform that way. And I think that's true of Anderson as well. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the trailer for the new film, Asteroid City, which comes out this summer. It's Tom Hanks, and he's a debutante in the Anderson universe. And there's a few lines from Tom Hanks in the trailer, and automatically he's got it. He's got the Anderson delivery. It's not the enthusiastic beat Tom Hanks we normally have. It's the kind of rigid, you know, deadpan Wes Anderson version of Tom Hanks. So you're fascinated instantly. But it must be on set that he controls that and modulates it. He must hear his films as much as see them and then gets the take he wants it to be. And I think that's why he returns to actors again and again, because he knows he's going to get the kind of the frequency he wants automatically from them. And they get it. Tilda Swinton, Bill Murray, all these kind of actors who come back, Jason Schwartzman, they kind of get the idea straight away. And there's a wonderful, I think, if you watch, again, closely observe the film, there's a wonderful yearning within it. Characters don't raise their voices. They don't get these big impassioned moments and cry or tear their clothes. But there's a great deal of pain on the screen that comes out. You know, they're not robots. Yeah. There's something remarkable that goes on in these performances.
Well, you mentioned how as protagonists usually have some unresolved form of unhappiness. You describe it as a common ailment in a Wes Anderson film.
Yeah, absolutely. They are, and this must be true of Wes Anderson himself. To understand that he must, he's incredibly empathetic where he experiences some of these things himself, because they are an astonishing study in the truth of unhappiness. Mm. One of the things that film as a whole sort of, mainly by necessity, does is it heightens human emotions. So we understand that we've only got 2 hours with this story, so you have to exaggerate in a way. And what Wes Anderson films do is they almost pull human emotions back to the register they often happen in, the distant unhappiness, the quiet unhappiness, this kind of sense of depression that hangs over people. It's kind of the wonderful, the Gustav in Grand Budapest, Ralph Fiennes' character, Monsieur Gustav, and he's almost bipolar. He's up and down. He has these kind of fierce, energetic moments, which fuel the chaos of the storyline, these kind of thriller-esque elements. But also he's depressed as well. So every character has a kind of deep emotional resonance, I think, that is the point of Anderson's inquiry. What's going on with the Fantastic Mr. Fox is the Fantastic Mr. Fox is deeply unhappy, but just hasn't confronted that unhappiness yet. Yeah. Yet it's a playful film based on a Roald Dahl children's book.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask about the Royal Tenenbaums, which we're going to be, we're focusing on this week in this screening. Where does the idea come from? I mean, you write that it's a film, this is how you put it, about the collateral damage done when marriages fall apart. So it seems like where it comes from is two parts. You already sort of referred to the divorce element. It's a kind of a reaction to that. It's very personal in that sense. But then there's also the fact that it seems quite influenced by the Glass family, J.D. Salinger's short stories and novellas that he wrote. So where does it come from, the Royal Tenenbaums?
I think like a lot of Wes Anderson things, it comes from many different directions. With the Royal Tenenbaums, there obviously was, it was written very early on. The kind of early treatment was written while he was still, even before he'd made Bottle Rocket. So he had a plan for it. So one element of it was about his parents' divorce. It was about his reaction to his parents' divorce. And the idea, not necessarily to make a film about the divorce itself, but how divorce affects the family, and particularly the children, from that. And I think from that, he and Owen Wilson came up with this wonderful idea of what happens when child geniuses, prodigies, grow up. Mm-hmm. And they failed in life. Great children have become failed adults. And they thought it was a wonderful idea. This household full of failed adults coming back. It's got a very kind of true to life about that, about adult disappointment is kind of what it's about. Which again, if you look at Rushmore, that's very present in Bill Murray's character in Rushmore, is that he's just disappointed with the way his life has turned out. And he cannot relate to that idea. And then, as you say, there's the Glass family part of the Salinger part of it, which again is dysfunctional families and about family, generational complication about what's in it for me. I think The Graduate is a big influence on particularly Tenenbaums and certainly Wes Anderson as a whole. That concept of generational ennui, the idea that you look at your parents and all you see is a sort of a full stop, a sort of bookend. You think, well, how can I aspire to that? So that is there. And then there's this beautiful idea of an aesthetic, and almost an intellectual aesthetic, that came from The New Yorker, that Anderson read The New Yorker as a student and sort of bought into its approach to the world, that it was, it's this kind of wonderful little kind of club you joined, The New Yorker, and who understood. It never changed its layout. It had short stories alongside extraordinary kind of detailed articles, great criticism. And this is also reprinted in the French Dispatch as well, which sort of echoes The New Yorker. He loved that. And I think he wanted to sort of take that and apply it to his own background and apply it to this idea of child geniuses. And then I think he was also inspired by the idea of ensemble. And he'd made Rushmore really as a three-hander. A Bottle Rocket is sort of a 3-4-hander. But with Royal Tenenbaums, he just thought, I want an ensemble, almost Woody Allen-esque kind of cast. We have lots of different characters. But at the center of it, he would have Gene Hackman. And Gene Hackman is the kind of the random factor you throw into this poised universe that creates your drama. And then he had that funny thing that all his script writing comes to, and all these kind of concepts come to, is that it's got to be funny. It's a quirky tale. It's got to tell jokes. It's got to be a bit crazy and bizarre. And all those things are fed into it as well. And finally, it's about New York. And not just a New Yorker, it's about New York. And it was a Texan who yearned to live in New York, a bit New Yorker. So there's a kind of transplanting of his own person to New York that goes on with that film.
Anderson also apparently mentioned that the film actually really came together when they found the Tenenbaum house in Harlem. That space, that actual place, was, I guess, quite important to him.
Oh, absolutely. It's a film about a house.
Yeah.
With a house and a family in a house. And, they've been scouting New York for a long time, and he'd been quite frustrated with... Yeah, I imagine it's very hard to work for Wes Anderson to be a location scout, because you're kind of looking for a place that doesn't really exist. It's just Wes Anderson's head. And to find it in the real world, most of the time it has to be built, like the ship in Life Aquatic, and all in the hotel in Grand Budapest. They have to kind of purpose build it because it's got a heightened universe. But with Tenenbaums, they were contemplating faking it in some ways. And they just found this house that was about to be done up as the wonderful brownstone. And of course, the house becomes a kind of emblem of the family. Each kind of family member has their own room. It's one of those, another great cataloguing that Wes Anderson does. And the room and the house tells the story as much as the characters do. And it's this lovely sort of sense, and this is vitally important, and it's kind of a New York thing, I think, of arrested time that goes on within the house. That the children are still living in their children, even though they've grown up, they've gone back to their childhood bedrooms, which haven't really changed. So it's kind of this kind of sadness about almost like immaturity. And of course, that all comes from the father. He can't grow up. He's a child. And they've become these sort of sullen adults, and he's a child. But it's all about immaturity, in the sense that this house can't grow up. And I think New York is sort of fixed in a time. Certainly, I think in Wes Anderson's view of New York, through the prism of The New Yorker, is something old-fashioned. So even though it's a contemporary film, The Royal Tenenbaums, it feels old-fashioned. It feels sort of like a period piece in an odd way. And that all comes from finding this incredible brownstone house and having this place to shoot in, which must have been difficult because you're right on top of each other. And once you're shooting within a fixed space, not a studio, all those angles and those sort of fixed structure of shot that Anderson sort of desires must have been very hard to pull off. And they're right on top of each other making that film. So I mentioned that sort of added a dimension to it, that they were kind of a giant family in this chaotic household.
Say something, if you would, about the epitaph that ends up on Royal's grave at the end. This whole show is a spoiler, so people will warn people. But what do you make of that? Because it reflects, it's not really true, and seems to say something broadly about Royal's view and just the film's sense of what's real and what's nostalgia and what doesn't exist and what does. Royal O'Reilly Tenenbaum, 1932 to 2001, died tragically rescuing his family from the wreckage of a destroyed sinking battleship.
It's interesting. It's all about sort of legends, isn't it? And it's about the myth that we sort of create to sort of cope with reality. And what the family have done is kind of, he's a fantasist, isn't he, Royal Tenenbaum? He always believes his own lies. He's creating this kind of world, and he can't, well, certainly for a lot of them, he can't see the damage he's doing to his loved ones. And the journey for Royal is sort of having some degree of confrontation with self. Yet, by Gravestone, they reassembled the fake Royal again.
Yeah.
like a sort of family in-joke that... And I suppose there is a little bit of, yeah, he does come to the family's rescue at the end. He does learn the error of his ways, and he's given a heroic send-off. But it's that beautiful Wes Anderson thing, isn't it? It's a contradiction. It's a kind of tribute and a mockery at the same time. It's a reminder that he was a pretty terrible dad, and he was a faker. Yeah. And the family haven't quite let that go, or have they? Yeah, and I suppose it's the whole idea that the kind of tenor of the film, if you want, is this idea of legends and folk tales and passing eras. You know, it's one other great inspiration for the film is the Magnificent Ambersons, directed by Orson Welles. Kind of the title, The Royal Tenenbaums, deliberately echoes the Magnificent Ambersons, about a family sort of fading into obscurity and losing their moment. And I think there's that goes with the Tenenbaums, is they're being left behind. They're becoming a gravestone, basically. And that's sort of what's written in the way it's been written on Royal's gravestone sort of alludes to that, a kind of passing. And that's a very common feeling in Wes Anderson's films. You think of Grand Budapest, that's about the passing of something great and wonderful and into obscurity. The French Dispatch is about this extraordinary magazine that is, you know, has lost its editor and is passing into history. And I wonder, you know, Wes Anderson must feel he lives in the wrong era almost, that he's always making these films that yearn for a different time that's been lost to him and faded away. And that's very much in the Royal Tenenbaums.
Let me ask you finally, where is he headed? Is his Wes Anderson style, has it been sort of, is it settled? Is it what it is? I mean, one of the things you mentioned in the book is Anderson is getting more Andersonian with age. So where is he headed stylistically, as far as you can tell?
Well, I suppose people who saw The French Dispatch might wonder if there's such a thing as too much Wes Anderson in one film. Because it was, you know, basically three different Wes Anderson films being thrown together, and it takes about three viewings to kind of sort of register it all, let alone make sense of it. And I take great joy out of Wes Anderson's films, and I've become a sort of hardened fan. And I loved The French Dispatch because it was almost challenging me and challenging me my Wes Anderson-ness to kind of meet him. And It is extraordinary, and his filmmaking is extraordinary, but he is getting increasingly, as I said, increasingly Andersonian. He's getting increasingly dense as a filmmaker. His worlds are so teeming with these kind of details that, in a certain sense, he's almost given up on inviting a casual viewer in. It's like, you're with me or you're not with me. And I wonder how far that can carry on. Are there enough of us out there, Wes Anderson acolytes, who will follow him wherever he goes? You watch The Trader for Asteroid City, his new film, and then you know exactly where you are straight away. It's a Wes Anderson film, color schemes, characters, quirkiness. You know, you may have new actors like Tom Hanks, but it's the old Wes Anderson. And that fills me with a kind of joy, because it's kind of something I can rely on. In filmmaking terms, you know, for me, it's Wes Anderson and the Coen brothers. And the Coens aren't working together right at the moment, but I hold on to the fact they may still. Yeah. They provide me with something, I think, beautiful in the fact I can rely on its oddity, and I can rely on its strangeness, and I can rely on that as a great pleasure. So I hope that Wes Anderson doesn't change, but I wonder how far he can go with it. I wonder where it can go to, what differences can, you know, what other things can be done with Wes Anderson, what other style of, you know, what other narratives, what other sort of fictional menus that he might venture into, and what they might be and how the Wes Anderson style might be applied to them. I would quite like to see a film a bit more like Rushmore again, where it's simpler. Yeah, very relative terms, a simpler, clearer story about just three characters and one, you know, strange situation, you know, as compared to the multifarious goings-on in The French Dispatch and Grand Budapest Hotel, and by the looks of it, Asteroid City, the new film. So, yeah, more power to him, more films from him, please. But, the little studio head in my brain goes, you know, where will this end, Wes? You know, is there such a thing as Wes, and what will that be like? But I hope we never get there.
Ian Nathan, thank you very much.
Pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
That's Ian Nathan. His book is called Wes Anderson, The Iconic Filmmaker and His Work. Thanks a lot.